This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, December 28th, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up ahead of next week's Iowa caucuses, Republican presidential candidates make pledges to restrict access to abortion and defund women's clinics. In Nigeria, religious leaders and LGBT activists fight a bill that would criminalize homosexuality. We'll also look at how the U.S. is responding to the effort. And we'll go to Indian-administered Kashmir, where a law that gives sweeping powers to the army is coming under increasing criticism. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm George Lavender with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. At least one person has been killed and 10 injured in an Israeli air raid on the Gaza Strip on Tuesday. The bombing came 3 years to the day since the start of Operation Cast Lead, the code name for the massive Israeli assault on Gaza in 2008. 13 Israelis and almost 1,500 Palestinians were killed during the three-week operation, which was internationally condemned by human rights organizations. Speaking on the anniversary, the country's most senior military officer, Benny Gantz, warned that Israel would launch another attack on Gaza sooner rather than later, and that the action would be swift and painful. Today, an Israeli tank fired into northern Gaza. The latest attacks come as negotiations continued between Hamas and Fatah, aimed at bringing about a reconciliation deal between the two Palestinian factions. In Egypt, the trial of former President Hosni Mubarak resumed today after an almost two-month delay, only to be suspended again until next week. The move comes amid growing opposition to the military government which replaced him. For FSRN, Rami Almagari reports from Cairo.
Former President Hosni Mubarak faces a number of charges, including the killing of demonstrators during the uprising in January. Many in Egypt are demanding Mubarak and his co-defendants be sentenced to death. Mubarak briefly appeared in court today, but officials say that hearings will resume regularly starting from next week. 6,000 complaints have been filed against the former president, his two sons Jamal and Ala, and six other defendants, including the former interior minister. All are charged with the killing of 840 demonstrators during the 18-day revolution that forced Mubarak to step down. The trial resumes amidst growing calls for the ruling military council to transfer power to a civilian administration immediately. In recent weeks, Egypt has seen mass demonstrations during which at least 14 people have been killed by security forces. Rami Almighari, Free Speech Radio News, Cairo.
In India, an eight-day strike by doctors working in government hospitals continues in the western state of Rajasthan. FSRN's Jasvinder Sagal reports.
Over 6,000 doctors working in Rajasthan government's hospitals are striking for an increase in their wages and more opportunities for job promotion. So far, more than 400 doctors have been arrested for protesting against the state government, but health officials have denied that the strike is costing the lives of patients. The Chief Minister for Rajasthan, Ashok Gehlot, has called on the doctors to immediately resume their duties but has refused to meet their demands. The state has dismissed at least 13 doctors and suspended 40 more. Instead of negotiating, the government is making alternate arrangements, including bringing in military doctors. Private hospitals are also being asked to provide services at government rates. Striking doctors have dismissed one of their leaders for wrongly calling of the strike. Meanwhile, doctors in other Indian states sent letters of support to strikers in Rajasthan and criticized the state government for being insensitive and callous. Jaswinder Sehgal, FSR in Jaipur, India.
More than 2,500 people have been released from prison in Cuba after a mass pardoning by the federal government. An upcoming visit by the Pope was among the reasons for the release. Several foreign prisoners were included in the release, but US contractor Alan Gross was not among them. Gross is serving a 15-year prison sentence after being convicted of crimes against the Cuban government earlier this year. A contractor for USAID, Gross was arrested for bringing communications equipment into the country without a permit, and has now been detained in Cuba for more than 2 years. His imprisonment is at the center of a diplomatic dispute between Washington and Havana. Human rights organizations have criticized the Cuban government's prison policies. The regime currently imprisons an estimated 70 to 80,000 people. Former Guatemalan dictator General Oscar Mejia will not face genocide and war crimes charges after prosecutors decided that he was not fit to stand trial. Mahia, who ruled the country from 1983 to 1986, faced charges over the massacre of indigenous communities in northern Guatemala. The killings took place during the long civil war, in which some 200,000 people died or went missing, according to United Nations estimates. Montana residents are attempting to recall senators and representatives who voted for the National Defense Authorization Act. Included in the act are provisions which would enable the military to indefinitely jail anyone suspected of terrorist activity, including U.S. citizens. The controversial bill, which has passed both legislative chambers, now awaits presidential approval before becoming law. Montana is one of only 9 states that allow for recall of members of its federal congressional delegations based on violations of oath of office. And those are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. I'm George Lavender.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Republican presidential candidates are heading into their first state caucuses and primaries, beginning with Iowa next week. On Tuesday night, 4 of the candidates participated in a town hall sponsored by pro-life group Personhood USA. The primary topic, how they would restrict legal abortion access if elected president. With many states already pushing measures to criminalize abortion and defund women's clinics, these candidates signaled their intent to make changes at the federal level. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports from Washington.
Prior to speaking at the pro-life event, Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, Rick Santorum, and Newt Gingrich all signed the Personhood USA pledge. The pledge says the candidates will advance laws based on the belief that life begins at the moment of conception and that the 14th Amendment applies to the unborn. Texas Congressman Ron Paul also signed the pledge, though he included a statement saying he would leave enforcement of a federal Personhood Amendment up to the states. Neither Paul nor former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney participated in the town hall. At Tuesday night's event, the candidates laid out what they would do once in the White House. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich.
On the very first day, I will sign an executive order reinstating Ronald Reagan's Mexico City policy that no U.S. money will be used overseas for abortions, period. I will also move to defund Planned Parenthood, and I would transfer the money from Planned Parenthood to adoption services so young women have a chance to choose life rather than a culture of death.
The Mexico City policy, overturned by President Obama during his first week in office, blocked any USAID funds for family planning organizations abroad. D.C.-based pro-choice activist Laura Kassir says the political rhetoric on the right is hurting the very women it purports to help.
This is something that's very scary, and I volunteer as a clinic escort at Planned Parenthood. And I see women coming who are desperately in need of this service. And we still have people standing outside of clinics harassing women. These laws, I think, make it more acceptable for people to further stigmatize abortion in our culture and make it something that women have to be embarrassed about and not talk about.
Kassir co-founded the Gender Equity Working Group at Occupy DC and has led teach-ins about the connection between abortion access and economic inequality. Meanwhile, Rick Perry kicked off Tuesday night's event by reviewing the anti-abortion measures he's championed as governor of Texas.
Just this last session of the legislature, it was especially meaningful, let me just put it that way, to sign my name to the state budget that defunds Planned Parenthood in Texas. And we've already seen 12 Planned Parenthood clinics shut down.
The Department of Health and Human Services said last week that this move violates the Social Security Act and extended the funding until March to give Texas lawmakers time to negotiate with the federal government. Governor Perry also emphasized he's recently changed his mind after talking to a pro-life activist on certain exceptions to his anti-abortion stance.
We had a fairly lengthy and heartfelt conversation about how she was conceived and raped, and looking in her eyes, and I couldn't come up with an answer to defend the exceptions for rape and incest.
But some, including Kassir, say the governor's views are hypocritical.
It boggles my mind that in the same breath, Rick Perry talks about executing 234 people in Texas, and in the next sentence talk about caring about the sanctity of life, caring about the sanctity of a ball of tissues, you know, a small embryo.
In individual states across the country, pro-life groups aren't waiting for the federal government to act. A proposed state constitutional amendment in Nevada would ban all abortions, even in the case of rape, incest, or threats to a woman's life, restrict access to certain fertility treatments and forms of birth control, and prohibit embryonic stem cell research. Earlier this month, a district judge ruled this fetal personhood ballot measure misleading to voters and demanded it be rewritten. If the measure's advocates can gather enough signatures by June, voters will weigh in on it next year. Kassir feels these state efforts pose the greatest threat to abortion access.
It's kind of a common misconception that, well, Roe v. Wade will never get overturned. It's not about Roe v. Wade getting overturned. It's about these small bills that slowly chip away at a right to an abortion.
Groups are also gathering signatures for personhood amendments in Colorado, Arkansas, Wisconsin, Tennessee, Georgia, and Virginia. The first amendment to make it to the ballot for a vote failed in Mississippi in November. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In Nigeria, lawmakers have sparked a fierce debate by proposing a bill to criminalize same-sex relationships. The bill prescribes up to 14 years in prison for anyone entering into a same-sex marriage or civil union and prohibits involvement in gay community groups or advocacy organizations. The country's minority gay community says if it becomes law, the bill will further increase the discrimination they face. Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
Ifeanyi is a Nigerian gay man who asked not to be identified by his surname because he fears for his safety. He says he has faced discrimination since his early childhood.
As a growing young boy, I was a little bit too effeminate, and people don't usually like me around them, especially the male ones. They always try to push me aside, that I am not supposed to be part of them. Also, when I was growing, my brothers were discriminating against me. Why do you have to walk like a woman? Why do you have to talk like a woman? Most things you do are ladylike, so. And then my sisters used to think I am gay. So because of that, sometimes when they punish my brothers in the house, my punishment is double, because they felt I was too reserved to be among them.
Despite the barriers, gay men have become increasingly visible in the Nigerian society in recent years. For example, Reverend Jide Macaulay heads a church whose members are mainly gays and lesbians. His sermons clearly support homosexuality.
I tell you again, Jesus came to die for our sins and our sexuality. You know, I'd like to say to you that I'm a happy, holy homosexual, if no one knows, because Jesus Christ came to die for my sin and not my sexuality. Someone say amen.
Amen.
You can tell your neighbor that I'm a happy, holy homosexual. You can tell your neighbor that I'm a happy, holy heterosexual. You can tell your neighbor that I'm a happy, holy transgender. It doesn't matter, because Jesus would not discriminate. Someone say amen.
3 years ago, Reverend Macaulay fled to Britain following threats to his life and those of his church members. Now, a section of the proposed bill prescribes a 10-year jail term for anyone who belongs to a gay group like Reverend Macaulay's church. The bill's proponents say that homosexuality is a threat to Nigerian culture and that they have support from the majority of Nigerians. Among the supporters is Mayowa Adebola, a resident of Lagos.
I don't like gays, because the gays are very disgusting to me personally. They are disgusting to me because it's just beyond my comprehension why a man would get involved with a man. It's not something I can think or imagine. So I don't like them. I'm very excited about the laws against homosexual, and I hope it works and it changes the orientation of the people. I'm happy that if someone is found guilty, could be sentenced to 14 years in prison. It's fine for me.
The bill has been passed by Nigeria's Senate and was introduced in Nigeria's lower parliament on December 7. If passed there, it will also require the signature of President Goodluck Jonathan in order to become law. Gay, lesbian, and transgendered Nigerians continue to mobilize locally and internationally alongside human rights organizations to oppose the bill. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Nigeria's legislation is just one of several anti-gay measures recently introduced or debated throughout the African continent. In Uganda, lawmakers are considering instituting the death penalty for homosexuality. And other countries, including Malawi, Cameroon, and Ghana, have similar efforts underway. For more on this and on the U.S. response, we go to Jabulani Chen-Korea, the African Program Coordinator for the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. She joins us from Johannesburg, South Africa. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be part of your show. Thanks.
It's great to have you. Let's start with the bill in Nigeria. If passed, what effects would it have on the ground for people and for grassroots organizations such as the ones that you work with?
It's unbelievably major in terms of how, you know, healthcare interventions are supposed to be developed. The fact that, you know, there'll be a complete decrease around tolerance. So it's, you know, it's the gays today and who will it be tomorrow? You know, and this is how conflicts, genocide, and all these, you know, very violent events that we witness in the world happens, you know. And so I think there's a lot of negative implications, but specifically towards service provision, you know, there's been a lot of progress made in advancing and creating healthcare interventions, for example, for men who have sex with men. So how are these proposed programs supposed to take place in an environment where MSM is prohibited, where it's now it will be outlawed, you know, and so on? So I think there's a lot that's under threat here. The fact that, you know, organizations would have to go underground or be exiled out of Nigeria, and, you know, one wouldn't even want to begin to think of the negative consequences that this law will have.
Earlier this month, President Obama came out and in opposition to the bill in Nigeria. He even threatened cutting off aid to Nigeria if it is passed. How do you see that move?
I don't think that cutting off aid is going to help any state at this stage, particularly in Africa, where we are highly dependent on aid. We clearly welcome the comments by President Obama in terms of asserting the fact that LGBT rights are part of human rights. And similarly, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has been amazing. She's been a fantastic ally. But I think in this particular issue, I don't think sanctions is the way to go. I think if anything, we need to look at the broader framework of human rights and how this is being applied within Africa, and, you know, and to focus on those broader aspects and not just to say, well, if this right is not attained, that we will impose these sanctions. I think there are a broad range of rights that are currently being violated within Nigeria, within many, many African states.
Well, I'd like to follow up on that. If you don't feel that withholding of funds or threatening of withholding of funds is effective in this fight against anti-LGBT legislation or policies in African countries, what do you see as an effective strategy, especially coming from someplace like the U.S., where people have been calling on the U.S. to not just put forth rhetoric, but to put forth some concrete, real proposals that are going to be effective? What do you see as an effective strategy?
Well, I think what has worked in the U.S., for example, has been persistent, and very consistent work by civil society organizations to engage with its states. The real fundamental issues that we have to address within Africa, and Africa really, in a holistic sense, really is a continent of dialogue. For example, on the Nigeria bill, the coalition working in Nigeria has been consistently communicating with the parliament, has consistently been drafting briefs to the Nigeria parliament, educating them on what are the implications should this bill be passed. And the implications are wider than sanctions. Implications are about that it will be a complete regression of human development. And Malawi, for example, and we hope that this is in a positive direction, but Malawi has, in the past month, called for a complete review of all its penal legislation. You know, and I think this is a step in the right direction.
As you look ahead to the next couple months, there is this pending legislation working its way through in Nigeria, meeting resistance from activists. Where do you see the movement to protect LGBT rights in Africa, whether in Nigeria or in other countries throughout the region? Where do you see it in the next few months?
Well, we are not going to stop with what we are doing, and that is that we are persistently going to shame states that want to continue criminalizing us, that we are going to shame them for their human rights records, you know, for the attacks on ordinary civilians who have peaceful protests. I think we will continue monitoring the situation. We will alert, the special rapporteurs where necessary if LGBT persons are detained. We want to live in democracies. Everybody desires to live in a country, in your country of choice, and you know where you can live freely and be who you are, and you know whether you are Nigerian or South African or Cameroonian, you want to be proudly part of that nationality in its holistic way. And no state is going to just continue criminalizing us because you know we love people of the same sex.
Jabulani Chan-Parea is the Africa Program Coordinator for the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. She joined us from Johannesburg. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
FSRN staff and reporters
would like to wish all of our listeners a happy new year and holiday season.
Listeners like you are the reason we work hard
to bring stories from the U.S. and international grassroots to the forefront.
From our collective to your family,
thank you for all your support.
And here's to another year of listener-powered independent journalism.
Learn more about it at fsrn.org.
In Indian-administered Kashmir, local government officials are trying to overturn a decades-old law which grants the army sweeping powers in their province. The Armed Forces Special Powers Act gives the army power to arrest civilians without a warrant, as well as to shoot to kill on sight. Human rights groups say this law, which also applies to other northeastern states, has resulted in massive abuse. Shanawaz Khan reports from Kashmir.
Last October, Umar Abdullah, the Chief Minister of Indian-administered Kashmir, announced that he would revoke part of the controversial Armed Forces Special Powers Act that gives the army broad authority to operate in Kashmir. The act, first passed in the 1950s, was designed to give the army power to deal with insurgents in parts of the country plagued by violence. It was extended to Indian-administered Kashmir in 1990, but though violence is an all-time low in Kashmir, the law has remained.
The biggest complaint among people here has been that though the situation has improved, the laws enacted because of the bad situation have not been removed. Today, I am glad to say that perhaps the time has arrived and the situation allows us to start removing those laws from some areas of the state. I cannot name the areas, but we are at a stage today that these laws would be removed from some areas within days.
Local residents assume Abdullah was referring to the districts of Srinagar and Jammu, where the Indian Army has not been operating. With the act remaining intact in the rest of the region, the move would be largely symbolic. The announcement, however, was met with fierce resistance from Indian Army and right-wing Indian political groups who say they need it in order to fight terrorism. Lieutenant General K.T. Parnaik heads the Northern Command of Indian Army, based in Indian-administered Kashmir.
Pakistan continues to have its terrorist infrastructure, which is intact. And unless we are able to remove interference from Pakistan, it may not be a correct time for us to think of revoking it even partially.
Under the law, the armed forces operating in Kashmir are immune from prosecution, which Kashmiri residents say has encouraged widespread abuse. Muhammad Ashraf Magre's nephew, Javed Ahmed Magre, was killed by the Indian Army in 2003. Magre says Javed, a 17-year-old student, was dragged out of his bedroom at night by patrolling army men and shot dead after they found the lights of his room on. The army called Javed a militant and said he died in crossfire. Though local police investigations into the case have established the family's allegations, the army troops have never been tried. Magre has been seeking justice for his nephew's death for nearly 8 years.
For prosecution against accused troops, permission from the Defense Ministry is required, and it has been pending with the Defense Ministry since 2007.
Srinagar-based rights activist Khurram Parvez says that there are many more such cases.
At least we know of more than 100 cases where prosecution has just stopped because army has not cooperated. Prosecution has just stopped because there is Armed Forces Special Powers Act protection.
Parvez says the act is not the only problem, however.
It is not the law which has been the reason for the human rights violations in Jammu and Kashmir. It is basically the lawlessness. Because if you look at the past, we have a very infamous group called Ikhwan, which is a pro-government militia. It was created and sponsored by Government of India. And one wonders under which law Government of India can create such an organization.
It's not the first time officials have tried to repeal this law. A high-profile commission set up by the Indian Prime Minister recommended its revocation in 2007. The army has consistently resisted such moves, even leading to riffraffs with other federal government ministries, which seemed to favor its revocation. Srinagar-based senior lawyer Zafar Shah says there are other laws that protect the army's interests, even if APSPA is revoked. But the level of immunity will not be the same.
Since the army finds that this act provides them complete protection and also immunity against any prosecution. So I feel that the army is trying to stick to this act.
The latest controversy has made it apparent that the Indian army is not willing to concede any ground, even in areas it no longer manages. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Molly Stentz, sitting in for Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was George Lavender. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapshi and Zane Carisley. FSRN is largely funded by listeners like you. Thanks to all of you who were part of our Clarity in the Chaos campaign and your ongoing support. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.